I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Although we're terrestrial beings, humans contribute vast quantities of debris to the world's oceans, from fishing gear to plastic bags. Much of this debris is synthetic, and if marine animals aren't ingesting it, they're at risk for becoming entangled in it. Today, we talk about the impact of entanglements on the populations of large whales and leatherback sea turtles and efforts underway to reduce the severity and occurrence of entanglements. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, marine animal entanglement is a global problem that results in the death of hundreds of thousands of whales, dolphins, porpoises, seals, and sea turtles worldwide each year. Entangled marine animals may drown or starve due to being restricted by the gear, suffer physical trauma and systemic infections, or they can be hit by vessels due to the inability to avoid them. Since 1984, the Center for Coastal Studies in Provincetown has freed more than 90 large whales from life-threatening entanglements. It's the only organization on the East Coast federally authorized by National Marine Fisheries Service to disentangle large free-swimming whales such as humpbacks and the critically endangered North Atlantic right whale. And joining us to talk about marine entanglements from our East Ham studio is Scott Landry, director of the Marine Animal Entanglement Response Program at the Center for Coastal Studies. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Mindy.
We also have in East Ham Dr. Kara Dodge from the UMass Large Pelagics Research Center. Good morning, Kara.
Good morning, Mindy.
And here in Woods Hole, Aaron Burke, Protected Species Specialist at the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning.
All right, Scott, this past weekend you were off the coast of New Jersey freeing a juvenile humpback. Tell us more about the whale in that rescue.
This appeared to be a young humpback whale, around 30, 35 feet long. Someone like that would weigh around 20 tons. The animal had become anchored in some fishing gear just off the beach of Manasquan Inlet. Some boaters found the whale. They reported it to the Coast Guard and to the hotlines for entanglement response. Now, we asked the Coast Guard if they could help us out, and they were very generous. They stood by the whale. As I said, it was anchored in the gear. They stood by the whale all night long because there's a lot of vessel traffic moving in and out of New York Harbor. That gave us some time to drive from Provincetown all the way down to New Jersey with our small inflatable boat, engine, and tools. The following morning, we went out with the Coast Guard. We found the whale still anchored in the gear. We worked with the whale for around 3 hours and finally managed to cut the whale free. Now, after we cut it free, the whale basically just stood still. And if you look online at YouTube and so forth of ad hoc disentanglements, a lot of people will interpret that as the whale saying thank you or some kind of magical moment with the whale. What the animal was exhibiting was shock or capture myopathy. Mm-hmm. It had no idea that it was disentangled. It took us a little while to coax the whale along. Finally, it sort of shook awake and swam off at a very high rate of speed. Mm-hmm. There was no thank you whatsoever.
Right. So now, were you the closest? I mean, why was there anybody else closer to New Jersey that could have done this?
No, in this case, the New York, New Jersey area is a very difficult area because they don't host many whales most years. Mm. Now, so that means that getting the experience for responders in that area is very difficult. Training for disentanglement takes around a 3 to 5 year apprenticeship. And so that really counts on having lots of whales to work on, to learn from, to start disentangling. Right. So that's a tough spot. And for some reason this year, they had a fair few humpback whales offshore. We had very few whales up here, and so we're sort of curious as to what's going on.
Yeah. Aaron, we were talking about that before we went on the air. The whales, where they're showing up and when has been kind of weird the last few years. They aren't following their normal, patterns.
Yeah, we've had very busy years in Cape Cod Bay, which is typical, but after that they usually move on to the Great South Channel and then the Bay of Fundy. But they haven't, this past year, they haven't gone on to those habitats, and Bay of Fundy has been pretty dry the last few years. So it's sort of mysterious. They're definitely in Cape Cod Bay, but they're being a little cryptic otherwise.
Yeah. So most of the large whales migrate south, for the winter. Is it uncommon then, Scott, to have entanglements this far north this time of year, like the one in New Jersey?
It's not too uncommon. For humpback whales, for example, they have to head down to the Caribbean. So the whales from the Gulf of Maine, where we are, have the shortest migration to their breeding grounds. So basically, they can stick around well into the winter, usually around January, February. That's when most of the whales are definitely gone. Mm. So it's not too unusual, but we thought things would be a little bit quieter at this time of the year.
Yeah. So as we mentioned, and you just mentioned, anyone who disentangles marine mammals must be authorized by the federal government. Center for Coastal Studies is a member of the NOAA Fisheries Large Whale Disentanglement Network. Explain how an organization becomes authorized. And then this is not uncommon for you to travel like that, as we're saying, to New Jersey.
Yeah, it used to be much more common for us in the past. When we first started disentangling whales back in 1984, we didn't have a sense of the scope of the problem. Then as we realized that it really is a big problem and that it's coast-wide, we partnered with the Fisheries Service to sort of codify everything. And that includes a permitting to do this work. And for us, that meant a lot of training to different groups all the way from the Bay of Fundy down to Florida. And that way we're all following the same type of protocols. And really the key part of this is keeping humans safe. Mm. Whales come second, actually, and a lot of people are surprised by that. But realize if we have one significant human injury or a mortality, very likely the permit that we work under would be in jeopardy. And therefore any whales after that injury would not likely get any help. Mm. So we have to be extremely conservative in favor of human safety.
Yeah, because one of the things that the whale doesn't know you're trying to help it. So you're there and it might be thrashing around and they're very large.
Yeah, they're really large and they're big wild animals. They really don't like to be approached by people. It's very confusing. People go whale watching all the time and the whales are not showing any fear of that for sure. But there's a certain point at which you're getting so close to the whale that they start to get uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And that is when they start acting unpredictably. That's why the people that we train tend to come from the whale research community. These are people who have had lots or hundreds, even thousands of hours of experience working with whales. And so we want them to understand whale behavior more than anything else.
And we hear a lot about the right whale entanglement because they, as we mentioned, are so endangered. But we have the humpbacks, as we mentioned, minke, fin whales in our waters. Are they all just as prone to getting entangled? Or is it more humpbacks and right whales that do this?
Well, it seems like humpback and right whales get reported entangled more often than the other species. And that's because a lot of people are working on those species, either through research on right whales and humpbacks or the whale watch industry targeting especially humpbacks around here. So simply those animals are seen a lot more than the other species like fin whales and minke whales. Mm-hmm. Certainly the other ones get entangled, but just less people are looking at them.
Right. We are talking about marine entanglements. If you'd like to join our conversation this morning, our toll-free number is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. In this case of off of New Jersey this weekend, the gear had anchored the whale to the bottom. But in other instances, you can get just more entangled in the rope. Talk about how the rope impacts the whales. I mean, this one went to the bottom, but they don't all go to the bottom.
Yeah, that's correct. And this is the tricky part of disentanglement. As we were driving down to New Jersey during the night on Friday or Thursday, I can't even remember what day it was, our big fear was that we were going to get out there in the morning and the whale was going to be gone and that it would be gone with a large chunk of that fishing gear. Whales are strong enough to break anchor. And unfortunately, that doesn't mean that they're disentangled or free. They're simply swimming now with the gear. And over time, especially in a young animal like the whale we had in New Jersey, they grow so quickly, the rope that they're entangled in will grow into them. It doesn't grow with them. Mm-hmm. So that opens them up to infection, blood loss, and it also inhibits their behavior, right. Like feeding, traveling, and so forth.
Yeah. It's a really awful way to die.
Yeah. We looked at right whales, for example, and on average, it can take 6 months to die from their entanglements. But we've had right whales who have survived with their entanglements for up to 3 years. So it's really tough. And the tough part of it is, well, you say, well, why don't we just disentangle them? The animals are on the go. They can hold their breath for 25 minutes. They can go any direction they want. And they certainly want to get away from us. Mm-hmm. And so it's a real challenge to get a free swimming whale disentangled.
Right. And now you've said that probably 80% of the large whale population becomes entangled at some point in their lives, but we don't necessarily see them all. Talk a little bit more about the work that's being done looking at animals with scars from entanglements.
Yeah, this is something that came out of the documentation from disentangling whales. So we take a lot of photos and videos, and that feeds into the research that can be used to understand the impact of entanglement, but also as a way of trying to find a solution to entanglements. And one thing that researchers here at the Center for Coastal Studies and New England Aquarium up in Boston realized is that scars left by entanglement are extremely distinctive. Mm. Those scars are not caused by the pattern of scars isn't caused by any other thing in their environment. So you can basically go out to the population and look at each individual whale each year, if you can find them, and see if they have any new scars from entanglement. Mm. So basically 10 to 15% of our whales get entangled every year and get themselves out of it.
And now, go ahead.
Oh, what I was just going to say is what that doesn't count are the whales who didn't survive their entanglement, mm-hmm. and it doesn't count the whales who are seen entangled, which are the ones that we can target for disentanglement.
And the other thing, too, I don't think people realize, especially with the right whales, I mean, the humpbacks and the right whales, they're distinctive. You can tell them apart from the others. And you have to have even this federal permit to take photographs of the right whales, don't you?
Yeah, that's one of those tricky things that they are so endangered that there's about 500 of them left. They're so prone to ship strikes that laws were enacted to try to reduce that and therefore increase distances that people can approach whales. So we do need to get close to them, so we need a permit to do that. And that's to identify who those individuals are and what's going on in their life.
Mm-hmm. And so how close can a normal person in a regular boat get? What's the distance?
Oh, 500 yards.
500 yards.
And at 500 yards, you're not going to see a lot of detail, mm-hmm. and therefore you're not going to know if that whale is entangled or not. So for right whales especially, most of our reports come from the research community, mm-hmm. folks who are carrying a permit to actually look at the whales closely.
And there's not
humpback
a lot.
Whales, it's different.
Yeah, there's not a lot of permits.
No, there's not. It's definitely very stringent in favor of the animals.
Yeah, let's talk to Liz, who's giving us a call from Truro. Hi, Liz.
Hello. Hello?
Yep, go ahead, Liz.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
I was just wondering, where's the funding come for all this?
The funding, good question. Who wants to answer that?
Well, I can answer part of it, and maybe Aaron can help out too. Funding for our program, which is basically an on-call program 365 days of the year, comes from the federal government, comes from the Massachusetts Environmental Trust, so those right whale license plates has been a huge help to us in the last couple of years. But increasingly, we have to rely on private funding as federal funding has declined.
Yeah. You've taken a hit in some of your programs.
Yeah. Our team used to be 6 or 7 people strong. Now we're down to about 3.5 people. And again, we have to be on call every day of the year. We need a minimum of 3 people on call every single day. So if you do the math, there's a lot of people making a lot of sacrifice. Right.
Aaron, you want to add anything to that?
No, Scott did great.
He did it. He got it. Liz, thanks for the call. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about marine entanglements with Scott Landry, director of the Marine Animal Entanglement Response Program at the Center for Coastal Studies in Provincetown, Aaron Burke, protected species specialist at Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries, and Dr. Kara Dodge from the UMass Large Pelagics Research Center. Kara, this past season was a very busy year for sea turtle entanglements, and you study leatherbacks. For listeners not familiar with them, how big are they and how are they different from other sea turtles?
Well, the leatherbacks that we see here off Massachusetts are primarily large subadults and adults. So these animals can be anywhere from about 400 pounds to over 1,000 pounds. So they're quite large. Mm. And they're different from other sea turtles in many ways, one of which is they can generate their own body heat. So you hear about this time of year, you start hearing about cold-stunned sea turtles. Leatherbacks do not cold-stun. Mm. And they also are exclusively feed on jellyfish, which is quite an unusual diet for a vertebrate.
Yeah. Now, it's been a record year for sea turtle entanglements. Do we have any theories as to why?
The last 2 years actually were quite high. Scott can chime in on that. But we're not exactly sure what that reflects, if it reflects an increase in the number of turtles that visit our coastal waters. We just don't have enough information on the number of turtles per year that use our coastal waters to feed.
Mm. Scott,
it was a tough year, tough 2 years, actually. We sort of count on about an average of 10 leatherback entanglement cases that are reported to us per year over the last decade. The last 2 years, last year we had 37 cases, this year 51.
Wow.
So, for example, when you fundraise for this type of effort, we think, all right, the average of 10 turtles will disentangle. We did not fundraise for 50, and we're not really we didn't plan for that. It did work out in the end. We worked very closely with the state of Massachusetts, to get as many of those turtles out as we could.
Yeah, well, and I would imagine you have different challenges disentangling a sea turtle than you do with a whale.
I think if you asked anyone on my team, they'd prefer to have a leatherback than a humpback or a right whale.
They're big, though. I mean, 1,000 pounds, that's a big turtle. And it's, again, it doesn't know that you're trying to help.
No, for sure. These animals are very panicked. They really don't want our help. They don't realize we're helping. But again, they're not 40 tons.
Right.
And they're not I don't want to put them down in any way, but they're not as complex a thinker as, say, mm-hmm. a humpback is.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, Kara, leatherbacks are endangered. What are some of the reasons?
Well, the primary reasons that are pointed out most often are bycatch and fishing gear, the subject of today's show. Mm-hmm. But there's also issues with these turtles climb up onto beaches to lay their eggs. And at that point in their life, they're quite vulnerable. So some of the nesting females are taken from the population when they're nesting, as well as the eggs. In some places, all of the eggs are harvested, which, of course, puts no new baby turtles back into the population. So I think nesting beach mortalities and bycatch and fishing gear are the two primary, at this point, reasons that leatherback populations are not recovering in some places.
There's so much gear in the water in areas where whales are also feeding that's difficult for them to avoid the rope. And I'm sure that's also the case for sea turtles, right? Your research has given you some insight into some other reasons that turtles get entangled.
Yes, I think, well, one of the reasons, so these leatherbacks are traveling thousands of miles from the tropics to come to our coastal waters, and they're doing that for one reason. They're here to eat. So they're basically focused when they're here on finding, capturing, and feeding on jellyfish. So they're not necessarily, prepared to navigate an underwater maze of end lines. Mm. So, it's sort of analogous to us if we were walking down a sidewalk and we were, say, riveted by something on our cell phone, our attention is absorbed, we might be more likely to run into somebody, step off the sidewalk, or trip over something because we're just focused.
Right. And they have these large flippers fans. They can't go backwards, right?
Yeah, we talk about it as leatherbacks don't really seem to have a reverse gear. So what we've seen with entanglements as well as when we capture turtles for our research project, their reaction to anything foreign touching them is to try to dive forward, move forward. There really is no backwards movement or reverse.
So, and they tend to sort of roll, so that really gets them more entangled rather than getting them out.
Yeah, I think that's part of the panic reaction that Scott was referring to, sort of a fight or flight response, and that, of course, increases the severity of the entanglement. Yeah.
So your research began tagging turtles that were disentangled, but you realized the data collected from impacted animals might not be giving you a true picture of their natural behavior. So now you're catching and tagging leatherbacks. Tell us how you catch them and what you hope to learn.
Yep. Starting in 2008, we started using a breakaway hoop net. It actually looks like a giant butterfly net to capture these animals. The net actually pulls off of the hoop once the turtle's inside, and then we're able to purse the turtle in the net and bring it on board our research vessel. So that's the technique we use to capture them. And so we'll approach a turtle that's at the surface. We try to approach from behind. They do not seem to be bothered by engine noise, but they do seem they're very visual, so if they see us approaching, they usually dive. Mm. But this actually gives us some insight, too, as well, to how these turtles are often being struck by boats in our area. They're not really reacting to engine noise when they're at the surface. Mm.
And so do you know where some of the turtles that spend the summer in Cape Cod waters winter? I mean, most of them travel south, right?
They do. The turtles in our study sample traveled to either South America or the Caribbean. These are the breeding size adults, and most of the sub-adults or adults that are in internesting years, we call it, traveled to tropical open ocean areas. So they travel quite far, thousands and thousands of miles annually.
How long do the tags stay on?
We have our tags set so that they should stay on for approximately 1 year. They have a corrodible release on the tag that should deteriorate over a one-year period.
So is the data being fed to you like real time? Is that how you're getting it? I mean, where they're at?
There's a little bit of a delay, but yeah, basically real time. Mm. So it depends on when the satellite is overhead. That's right. When we're getting the information. The turtle breaks the surface. The antenna on the tag breaks the surface. And that information is transmitted to a satellite, which is then transmitted back to us.
Is there anyone else tagging sea turtles?
Well, for leatherback turtles specifically, there's only three projects at this point in the world that are using the free-swimming capture hoop net technique that I'm talking about.
Right.
So there's a program up in Nova Scotia, Canada. There's also a program run by NOAA Fisheries in California that's doing it and our project here off Massachusetts.
I would imagine, you know, anytime you have any of these transmitter tagging things, they're always expensive, right? So how is that? How is it funded? Same as what we were talking earlier, as Scott was saying, or is your funding different?
We apply for competitive grant funding, but we also get some funding directly from NOAA Fisheries, which is federal government. And we've also gotten some competitive funding as well for the work through National Fish and Wildlife Foundation.
So what's next in your research? What are some of the other questions about sea turtles that you hope to answer, and how might you go about it?
I think there are three things that we should try to pursue for leatherbacks in this region. I think we do need to do more satellite tagging of disentangled animals because one of the things we're interested in finding out more about is the rate of re-entanglement. And satellite tagging, this will probably come up a little later, is a good way of figuring out if sea turtles do actually, once they're disentangled, they just get entangled again. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing we need to look at. I also think we need to get higher resolution data, which you can get from tagging them with archival tags and then collecting the tag from the animal. And we started doing that last summer. And we'd also like to get some more innovative technology involved to get video imagery of mm-hmm. these animals, particularly in areas with high gear densities, to see what their behavior is like. So using something similar to the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute Shark Cam, something like that.
So a turtle cam.
Turtle cam, exactly.
Scott, the ocean is pretty vast, so how do you find these entangled animals? I mean, you mentioned the researchers and some fishermen and things, but we don't get them all, do we?
No, we don't. And Carr's work actually was one of the few times where you could actually watch an animal. Once we disentangled it and she tagged it, you could actually watch the animal and sort of monitor it. I didn't realize how stressful it would be because as she would call in the middle of the night and say, look, one of our tagged turtles has gone still, which is not what you want to see. We would get out there by dawn, and at least in one of our cases, we found one of our leatherbacks that we had disentangled had become re-entangled and drowned. And so it's very hair-raising to actually watch animals in real time swimming in these habitats.
Yeah.
The other way we find out about them is through regular research surveys, for example, with right whales by plane. Humpback entanglement sightings often come from whale watch vessels, the research community, and actually, to a lesser extent, the fishing community. What we've been doing increasingly is doing outreach to the recreational boaters, asking them, please report your entanglement, stay with the whale, and wait till we get there. And so we try to ask as many people as we possibly can to increase the amount of time that whales are actually watched by people and therefore monitored for entanglements.
We're talking about marine entanglements. If you'd like to join our conversation, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So, Scott, walk us through the response and how you actually do the disentanglement. And I know it's the turtles are probably a little bit different than the whales. So let's start with the sea turtles.
Sure. The technique we use for leatherback turtles came out of what we do for whales. Basically, what we want to do is establish a work line on the animal, which sounds counterintuitive. You know, the turtle's already wrapped up in rope. Why would you add some more rope? But basically what we're trying to do is add a leash onto the animal's entanglement. Now, for a turtle, what we're trying to do is get that leash underneath the turtle. That way we can relieve the downward pressure on the turtle, realize it's at the surface breathing, and there's a downward pressure from the gear that's trying to pull it under. So we're just trying to help the turtle along, maintain the surface. In the case of turtles, we almost always try to unwrap the turtle, only because they often have so many wraps that if you try to cut something, that can have very surprising results, oftentimes ones you don't want to have.
Right.
So you can make it so that the turtle is now swimming off with rope. So the scary thing with leatherbacks is that because they panic so much, they wrap themselves up like a spool. And what that's doing is actually shortening their leash. So the turtle is actually drawing itself under. So that's why it's critical to get to them quickly. Otherwise, they're just going to drown themselves.
Yeah.
Now, with whales, they're stronger than that, and they don't have quite that same problem usually.
Yeah. And so with the whale entanglements, as you were talking earlier, these are much larger animals, and you have to be really careful. So how do you go about getting a whale entangled?
Sure. With most of our whale entanglements are free-swimming animals, so they're, you know, going about their business just as they would want to. We approach them with a small inflatable boat that we can inflate from our larger work vessel, Ibis, stationed in Provincetown. Now, with that boat, we can get as close as possible to the whale and throw a grappling hook into the gear that's wrapped around the whale's body. Now, attached to that grappling hook are very large buoys. This is all from the whaling techniques of using very large kegs or buoys. And that's to keep the whale at the surface as much as possible. But also, if a whale goes on a dive, we still have the buoys on the surface marking where that whale is because we literally can't see the whale underwater. Now, what we'll do is keep adding buoys very slowly over time, trying to convince the whale to basically say, if you move forward, it's going to be a little bit painful. If you stop, it's less painful. So we're trying to train a wild animal in a very, very small amount of time to just rest at the surface, and that'll give us time to use hook-shaped knives at the end of very long poles and very, very carefully cut away the gear from the body. And what we're trying to do is make it so that we're not leaving something on the whale that's going to kill it later on down the road.
Exactly. So, and sometimes you actually try using sedating these animals, and that's a tough one, trying to figure out how much sedation do you use, and you know all the possible side effects from that.
Yeah, and that's so tricky because, first of all, we're not always successful. Especially with right whales, our success rate is, say, something like 50 or 60%. So we're trying to increase the odds that we're going to be successful at disentangling it. So one of the ways we've tried was sedation, and that's still ongoing with veterinarians like Michael Moore at Woods Hole, and trying to figure out the dose of an animal that has no veterinary history whatsoever.
Right.
You know, there's not a place in the world where there's a right whale where you can practice this kind of thing. So it's really tricky, and we have pulled it off at least once or twice so far. The expense is very high. It makes for a very complicated at-sea operation, one that can be dangerous for people. These chemicals are scary.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to find other, while we're working on sedation, find other techniques like using cutting arrows. So in other words, realize these animals are moving at a high rate of speed. They're moving away from us. We biopsy whales using crossbows all the time. That's to get a genetic sample to figure out their family history. So we can modify those arrows to actually cut through rope. Mm. And that's a technique that we've used on a few different whales to date, and it's worked out really well because it doesn't put us at any risk,
right,
and it doesn't put the whale at any risk.
Okay. So are there instances when you can't free an entangled animal, and then if you can't, what do you do?
We just keep trying. Mm-hmm. We've never given up on a whale. We never will. We just keep trying basically until the whale dies. And when it dies, if we're lucky enough to retrieve the carcass, which is actually a pretty rare event, we can learn a lot from that whale.
Mm-hmm.
What we're trying to do is we can't disentangle every whale simply because we can't find every entangled whale. But from every single disentanglement, we're trying to get a minimum of information that managers can use, that fishermen can use, that conservationists can use to try to solve this problem in a real way. You know, disentanglement is not a solution to entanglement, but we need the information to find a way of stopping this.
Right. We've got an email from Doug who says, thanks for the work you do. I'm wondering if you know what the percentage of whale entanglements in lobster gear. Have there been any changes in lobster gear or other gear to prevent entanglements?
Aaron, do you want to talk about that?
I think it's a fairly high proportion of the gear is just rope, but often when we can identify the gear, it's generally gillnet or lobster gear. The lobster fishery has gone through a lot of changes in the last few years, including sinking ground lines and modifications to the buoy line, like attaching breakaway links and gear marking to try to minimize the risk. Sinking the ground line was a huge thing to when you fish with trawls, your pots are connected in a string on the seafloor. The ground line is the line that connects them, and when you bring that to the bottom, you're taking a lot of rope out of the water column. So now the large whale take reduction team is trying to tackle the risk with the National Marine Fisheries Service of vertical lines.
And thanks to the Provincetown Center for Coastal Studies, we do have some diagrams at our website to illustrate how certain types of fishing gear sit in the water. So when you see those diagrams, you can begin to realize how much line is associated with fishing and how easily an animal could get entangled. So that's on our website, capeandislands.org. Dana is giving us a call from Wellfleet. Good morning, Dana.
Oh, good morning, and thank you very much. Hi, Scott. I remember working with you as a volunteer at the center, data collecting.
Oh, hey, Dana.
Are you still on the line?
Yeah. Go ahead, Dana. We're listening.
Okay. Oh, sorry. Okay. Well, you know, this certainly is an implication of our fishing practices as a species ourselves. But I wanted to comment on the irony of that little vignette from the Whaling Museum, that gentleman from the Whaling Museum talking about how they killed whales. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of romanticized in a mode, you know, of such an inhumane practice. And yet, you know, during a show when we're talking about trying to save their lives, I just wanted to make that comment.
Yeah. All right, Dana. Thanks for the comment. We appreciate that. Part of the, you know, history of whaling, two different, I guess, topics. So that wasn't really part of the program. But anyway, these larger marine mammals such as whales are here in the summer and spring with the right whales. And then they move to the southern waters during our winter. So what happens to animals found entangled in southern waters?
That's a good question, actually. We just, ironically enough, to sort of further this conversation, we partnered with the International Whaling Commission. Whaling Commission is actually trying to deal with the whale bycatch issue the same as other conservationists, fishermen, and so forth. We did a training in the Caribbean for responders to start that process of getting them used to entanglement response. And so many of the whales that they deal with in the Caribbean are carrying gear from their northern feeding grounds, whether that's here in the Gulf of Maine or Norway on the other side of the Atlantic. So animals are carrying gear basically across the face of the globe. They're strong enough to carry gear thousands of miles. And I wanted to further Aaron's point that we put together a paper a few years ago looking at all of the gear that we've removed from right whales and humpback whales. And we did find a preponderance of lobster gear in there, but the conclusion that we drew was not that lobster gear per se was more risky than any other type of fishing gear. It's simply that there was a lot more of it than there were other types of fishing gear. And so our broad conclusion was that it really doesn't matter what you're trying to catch, what kind of fishing gear you're using. If you're using durable synthetic rope, entanglements are going to happen.
Yeah.
So that can be aquaculture. That can be mooring lines. The more rope we add to the environment, the greater the risk is to animals.
When the animals are disentangled, are they tagged to keep track of them?
We wish we could. Honestly, the technology for whales and tracking is not as far along as I think people would assume.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, for example, in the Gulf of Maine, I don't know of a single whale who is being satellite tracked.
Mm.
So we really can't do that. The only time we do track a whale is if we cannot disentangle it that day. We designed a special buoy with a satellite and a VHF transmitter that we can tie into the gear that's attached to the whale's body. That'll allow us to track the whale, wait for good weather, wait for the whale to come back inshore, wait till we have a better idea about how to disentangle it. And indeed, one of the right whales who's, I think, got one of the longest track histories was a 100-day a track line of a right whale that we desperately tried to disentangle.
Mm.
And in the end, the tracking buoy found his carcass. The whale died from its entanglement before we could get to it.
Mm. Most people, fishermen, scientists alike, agree that preventing marine animal entanglement is an important goal. The question is how? And Aaron, this is where I'm going to bring you in here. Aaron is a protected species specialist at the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries. So describe your role, the role, I should say, of the DMF in entanglements.
Well, we partner with the Center for Coastal Studies to perform the aerial surveillance in Cape Cod Bay. We get some grants from the feds, and, you know, we are trying to figure out the incidence of these endangered species in our waters and look at the potential impact of our fishing gear and try to find ways to minimize that impact. So we partner with NIMS, we partner with CCS to try to further those goals. And when you're thinking about entanglement, there's sort of two different categories. You know, if you're trying to minimize it, you can think about reducing the severity of an encounter versus reducing the frequency of an encounter for an animal. So, and in those two cases, you know, there's different things that, you know, there's different ideas for how to make that happen.
Yeah, it gets a little bit confusing because there's so many agencies involved.
Yes, there's a lot of acronyms.
And some of the animals who become entangled are protected by federal law, some are not. So in addition to contracting out the disentanglement work of the Center for Coastal Studies, the Department of Marine Fisheries has also been proactive into researching fishing gear modifications, as we talked about, that could prevent or lessen the severity of entanglement. So what are some of the gear modifications that we've seen over the years to reduce the entanglements?
Well, I think the simplest one is certainly sinking the ground line. The Division of Marine Fisheries, we did a study where we put loggers on the ground lines to quantify their height off the bottom to see how risky were they. So that's the simplest one. But there, there's been a lot of research over the years to look at links on the buoy that would release, when the whales encounter it, and also ways to keep the buoy line coiled inside the trap or in a compartment in the trap. And so when the fisherman comes and wants to haul his gear, he can hit a button and the buoy will rise to the surface. People have talked about glow-in-the-dark ropes, stiff ropes. There's a bunch of different modifications that have been thrown, bandied around.
Scott Krause from the New England Aquarium has been doing some interesting research with right whales and rope color. Aaron, can you explain his research and what he's been finding?
Yes, Scott just presented that a couple weeks ago at the Right Whale Consortium. This is an offshoot of a study of the right whale eye that they've done with a group. And so they took 1-inch thin PVC pipe and they had it different colors, red, orange, black, and green. And they put it in the track of swimming right whales. And they were looking for a change in behavior in the animal and see if that correlated with the color. And they did get some results. They did see change in behavior and they did see a difference in the colors. And they found that orange and red, the animals were less likely to encounter that, to hit that rope, and they seem to have a change in behavior at a much greater distance than the black and the green ropes. So right now they have some fishermen testing out orange rope, but I don't know what...
Yeah, it's beginning. We're not there yet. So I don't know if any of you are familiar with the research, out of the University of New Hampshire about humpback whale feeding techniques. They hadn't realized that the whales dive to the bottom, rolling around to get sand lancet, I guess a favorite food.
Yeah.
That would make it easy to become entangled if fishing gear were there. This is really interesting, though, that they put the cameras, I guess, is how they figured this out, right?
Well, that and also inference from traditional studies on humpbacks. Years ago, the center figured out that humpback whales are mostly right-handed, and very few of them are left-handed, the same percentage as in people. The way we figured that out was looking at the scuffing on the side of their head. And what we found out is that humpbacks go down to the bottom and dig around in the sand for sand lance. And most whales will turn on their right side, about 10 to 15% on their left side. But what that indicates to us for entanglement is that, if there is a lot of rope on the bottom, there is going to be risk there for that species. We haven't figured out with right whales if they are actually grubbing around in the bottom for food. We do see right whales with mud on their heads, so it at least suggests that. So again, as soon as you find one good avenue to go down with gear modification, then you find some other piece of information that makes you think, oh, no, how are we going to do this?
Right. We're talking about marine entanglements. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Tell us more about the Atlantic Large Whale Take Reduction Plan and some of the proposals they've come up with for preventing entanglements.
Well, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, one of the amendments required that there be take reduction teams for certain species, when takes got above a certain level. And what the take reduction team is, it's a collection of scientists and fishermen and managers and conservationists who are trying to develop ways to modify fishing gear or to minimize the risk of entanglement in fishing gear. And over the years, there have been, the team has recommended strategic closures. The sinking ground line was back in 2008 was probably the most significant change that they put in place. And now the draft vertical line reduction strategy, the comments are closed on that, but the feds had released that. And so now we're waiting to see what they will do with everyone's comments and what track they want to follow for that.
What are some of the criticisms of the vertical line proposals?
Well, there, you know, if you have a certain number of vertical lines in the ocean and you want to minimize that, that seems fairly simple. But first you would have to know how many you have out there to begin with, and that's not something that is known. So NIMFS used a model and various surveys. Massachusetts, we ask fishermen for that information, including their buoy line data. But other areas, they don't get that information. Mm. And then if you wanted to constrict the number of vertical lines, you would also have to make sure that, you know, the number that were out there right now was the max that were allowed to be fished. But there's actually a lot of latent effort in the lobster fishery. So even if you made the current number go down by 30%, there's still, you know, a portion of effort in the fishery that's not being used. And so they could legally, you know, you could legally wipe out that 30% just by guys, you know, going back out fishing or, you know, fishing 800 pots instead of 600. So it's sort of not as simple as it seems.
Yeah. Another conundrum with entanglement is that the people most likely to come across an entangled animal, fishermen, have a disincentive for reporting. Aaron, can you explain why fishermen are leery to report entanglements?
Well, oh, gosh.
Scott, you want to help her out?
Scott?
Sure. basically, I think that the short answer is that fishermen are afraid that it's going to impact their fishery or the fishery of friends. So in other words, if there's too many takes in a given year, and I can tell you every year we are over the number of takes. And what I mean by that is the number of whales that can be killed by ship strikes or entanglements. Mm-hmm. For right whales, it's about half a right whale a year. For humpbacks, it's about 1.5 a year. We are always over that, mm-hmm. that level every year, as long as I've been working. And so people are afraid that if another whale gets reported, you know, dead, entangled, washes up on a beach with their family's gear, something like that, they're afraid that it's going to impact their fishery, for example, a closure of some kind mm-hmm. or a gear modification. And so they're afraid of that. They're mm-hmm. afraid of that that potential change, which I understand. But again, what we try to point out is, look, do you want the whale to wash ashore dead with your family's gear on it? If you can call us before that, we can get it out. You can work with us to get it out, and we'll try to make this into a win-win situation as best we can. But again, the stakes are very high, not only for fishermen but also for whales. We're taking too many of them.
Right. Now, the Center for Coastal Studies has reached out to local fishermen to try to educate them about recognizing and reporting entanglements. How's that been received?
I think it's been received well. For example, we work with the Fishing Association in Chatham. We work with the Massachusetts Lobstermen Association every year. I think that people genuinely understand, and of course fishermen are human beings like anyone else. They just want to help these animals. Mm-hmm. And I think it's been well received. I think part of the problem, though, is that the likelihood of a fisherman setting out to sea on any given day and finding a whale or a turtle stuck in his or her gear is actually low. Mm. And people say, well, what do you mean it's low? You're telling me that we're killing too many whales. Well, when you look at the absolute number of whales out there, there's only 500 right whales. There's only 1,000 humpback whales in the Gulf of Maine. So to give you a sense of scale, the town of Truro has 20 square miles of land and 2,000 people living in it. The Gulf of Maine has 70,000 square miles, and there's only 1,500 right whales and humpbacks there. So the chance of you going out and finding one of those animals in your gear is quite slim, especially when you consider the whale may have broken anchor during the night and carried off part of your gear. Mm. So it's... We ask fishermen to report them, but in the end, I'm not even sure what the likelihood of a fisherman finding a whale in their gear is.
Is that what you wanted to say, Aaron?
I would agree with that. Yeah. The likelihood of seeing it is very slim, and I think it's more of a weariness because fishermen have done a lot over the years, especially Massachusetts fishermen and Massachusetts lobstermen, but because the problem is so wide-reaching and there's gear all along the East Coast and often we don't know the origin of the entanglements, that, you know, we have to start putting in place reductions on a broad scale. It's mm-hmm. difficult to pinpoint things. And Massachusetts is a capture point for a lot of whales. You know, a lot of whales come through our water, so we often see a lot of entanglements. That doesn't mean that they originate here. Right. So I think it's just everyone's frustrated with trying to really pinpoint where and when this problem occurs.
So what happens to the fishing gear once it's removed from the animal? Do you try to determine what fishery it came from or even the specific fisherman?
Well, the National Marine Fisheries Service, they have gear analysts who look at the gear, see if there's any markings, any permit numbers. If there are and they can identify the fishermen, they will interview them. They're trying to find out where the fisherman fishes, when he set gear, has he lost any gear recently. So really trying to investigate the case and find out everything that we possibly can about that gear and when and where the whale might have encountered it.
Mm.
Yeah. That brings up another point that's very tricky, that oftentimes when we disentangle a whale, we'll find a long piece of rope and you can see clearly that the line has been cut. So in other words, buoys may have been cut off the animal, turtles as well. And so people, again, it's probably that fear of being identified by fishery.
Mm-hmm.
But what that really means is that it puts the federal government in an awkward position. There's another take of an animal. Which fishery do they assign it to? One way of looking at it is then they assign it to every fishery. Mm-hmm. And so it really doesn't do anyone a lot of good, you know, to not just be open and honest about it.
All right. I want to go back to just the funding for a second, Scott. We talked about how you guys are funded and some of the cuts you've had. What programs are in jeopardy now?
Ask which ones are not.
Oh, really? Yeah. I was going to say, because I thought I had heard something like with Stormy's work in the, you know, research of, you know, what the whales are eating and that kind of stuff. I was hearing that that program is in jeopardy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The habitat studies program for right whales is definitely in jeopardy. The entanglement response is definitely in jeopardy. Our humpback whale studies that's been going on for 35 years is in jeopardy. It's one of those things where do you pay for the EMT only when they go out and help someone, or do you pay for them all the time so that they're ready to do this work?
Yeah.
And, of course, budgets are just getting tight for everyone. We don't think – we're not taking it personally. We understand why this happens. But there's a real danger that we're going to lose a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Our grant from the National Marine Fisheries Service, they've been really diligent in trying to get money for us every year, and we appreciate that. But their budgets have been shrunk as well, so that sort of trickles down to us. And with Stormy's work, you know, having that long-term time series of habitat and the water temp and how it affects the right whales, mm-hmm. you know, it's very good for looking at climate change and things.
Sure.
But we were in a position where we had to make a tough decision. And at this point, we're getting, you know, 50-60, you know, percent of the right whale population is coming to Cape Cod Bay every year. And we couldn't very well cut the aerial surveillance because we get so much information out of that. And, you know, disentanglement is also very important. So we had to cut back on those habitat surveys, unfortunately.
So basically what you're looking at is you've got all of these programs which are important in their own right, and you have to decide which one is going to have the cuts.
Yes.
That's a tough one.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's also it's one of those things where you can cut the foot off despite the face, or what that metaphor is. But if our aerial survey team doesn't go out there into the bay to survey for right whales, they don't see the entangled ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So therefore, we have less work to do and the entanglement response end.
Yeah. Doug, who emailed us a little earlier, also wanted to know if we could touch on seal entanglements.
Oh, boy, that's a tough one. Seals are just such a controversial issue, I guess, on the Cape. Definitely they are – we get reports – we have a 1-800 hotline that's manned 24 hours a day. We get so many reports of entangled seals. They are actually very tricky to deal with for entanglement response. And we're trying to work with, for example, IFAW here on the Cape. Mm-hmm. They're the folks who are going to really be spearheading that effort to disentangle them. But the numbers are really quite high.
I see there's a lot of a lot of seals. If you go on a boat anywhere around that in Monomoy and Chatham area, you're going to see seals.
Right, and what you're getting is a lot of tourists calling up extremely upset.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they really want us to do something about these animals, and there's a lot of them.
Yeah.
Well, they often get entangled while depredating from the gear, while taking fish from the gear. So, you know, in a gillnet, they may be working down a gillnet, eating the bellies out of the fish, and then, you know, pretty soon they make a mistake and they get mm-hmm. wrapped up. And so what do you do then? You know, you have to often cut them out of the gear, mm-hmm. and then sometimes they're left with something around the neck, like a collar of netting or something.
Yeah. Yeah. So just like in the 30 seconds we have left, is there anything people can do? I mean, just report what they see things? I mean, what can we do?
One thing I would definitely encourage people to do, and I don't want this to sound bad in any way, is The Massachusetts Environmental Trust, they surprised us, and they have really been a godsend to us in the last 3 years. It really saved our program. So getting those license plates, mm-hmm. that has been a direct help to us, and we appreciate it.
Okay. And our biggest message would be call the disentanglement hotline. We had a lot of ad hoc turtle disentanglements this summer and people who didn't call it until later. So calling the hotline is extremely important.
All right. Scott Landry, director of the Marine Animal Entanglement Response Program at the Center for Coastal Studies in Provincetown. Dr. Kara Dodge from the UMass Large Pelagic Research Center and Aaron Burke, Protected Species Specialist at the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries. Thank you all for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks
Thank
so
you,
much.
Bindi.
And thanks to Brian Morris for engineering assistance in Eastham. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.